Test 1, 2.
Cratery,
brother.
I feel like it's too early for the eggnog tangent right now. You know what I mean? We gotta hit him with the facts, man, of what we're doing right now, man.
This is the first one.
Yes.
Number one. First podcast, you know, right off the jump. We got a lot of things to talk about, a lot of things to get into. This.
All right. Fuck. Hey guys, my name is RC.
My name is Kay Wonder.
And on the wheels of steel. DJ
Serious. And that was the wonderfully eloquent DJ Serious.
The incomparable sounds of DJ Serious.
And we are Cratery, man. And guess what? We're fucking doing a podcast.
We're here now. It's no turning back.
And for our very first one, we actually have a special guest. We got Rashad Smith of Tumbling Dice Productions, man. A guy who many of you in the digging world may or may not know. But if you don't know, you're about to find out.
He is about to find out something.
He is a guy who has made hit records, worked with people like, you know, Biggie, Craig Mack, Nas, Busta Rhymes, Erykah Badu. However, you know, he's also a massive Cratehead, and he's a beast.
Your man is a beast.
You know what I mean?
Truth be told.
And some of the stories that he actually shares with us on our very first episode are just absolute jewels. You know what I mean? From production to straight up old school digging stories, and just, you know, his own, you know, experiences as a producer, record executive, and you know, overall just, you know, legend in this hip hop thing.
Basically, y'all gonna learn today is what we can say about this particular situation.
And with that, I think we should get into our conversation, man. Our very first episode with the one and only Rashad Smith.
Well, my very 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 first experience is me living in Flatbush, Brooklyn, and hearing Jimmy Spicer's Super Rhymes. That was like mind blowing to me, and I even remember, even going further back, the first hip hop record that I recognized was hip hop was Fatback's band's King Tim the Third. You know what I'm saying? Any real historian of hip hop will agree with that, you know. And then you got some people that will even challenge that and say that there's other records. They'll say James Brown is the first rapper, or, you know, Pigmeat Markham, Here Comes the Judge, and then there's a gospel record too. I think it's the Gospel Nears or something like that. I can't think of the record right offhand, so excuse me. I've heard so many variations of this thing that we call rap today. Hustler's Convention was definitely in the 70s as well, and you know, forms of poetry too is all early forms of hip hop. You know what I'm saying? So, what the MCs and DJs did, originating from the Bronx, made it what you would compare to jazz, swing jazz, the bebops, you know, swing bebop sound, where you had you know, like Dizzy Gillespie and just swinging the words, swinging the instrument, swinging the rhythm. So, you know, it developed. But yeah, man, those were my, getting back to the question, definitely my first experience. And I think this was in 79, 80. Not to even age myself too much, but yeah, man. But I was there definitely for the beginnings of hip hop. So, yeah, and I know hip hop definitely, from now that, even more research that I'm doing, that it was birthed even around the year I was born in '70s. You know, in the 70s. I don't want to give up the end. Yeah, but so anyway,
definitely. So this has been a part of your life, you know, since your youth. And what was the thing that sort of attracted you to it, in terms of like which element of it did you get involved with first? You know, was it a dancing thing? Was it a DJing thing, like rapping?
Okay, so,
like,
which
element did you get attracted to first?
Listening to breaks, and then I'm pretty sure when, you know, people in my age group, some form or another, that growing up in a home, they've had, you know, those old school record players where it was like the whole coffin, right? So it's like you either, you know, some of them were different. Some of them had like the lights on the side and the speaker, you know, so every time you played the music, it would trigger the lights off and give you like this little Christmas light thing. And then they'll have like the some of the ones was you could lift up the top, and then you know, you could, and they had the record player, the 8-track recorder, and they didn't have cassette, but they had the 8-track where you could record, and then the radio in there. And so what I would do was they had local DJs around my area in Flatbush, and a lot of them would you know, they'd do their own kind of edits where they would, you know, take the record, and later on this same method I would do pause loop tapes, you know what I'm saying? So it's like,
word,
I would
have pause mix.
Yeah, oh yeah. So I would have a Kool and the Gang record, like Chocolate Buttermilk, and then the break part, you know, let the break go, pause, bring the record back, pause it again. So I would do
what year are we talking that you're making pause mixes of Chocolate Buttermilk?
Oh man, I was doing that with an 8-track, bro, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah,
crazy,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, yeah. So the first two breaks I ever had, just, y'all gonna laugh, man. The first two breaks I had, bro, was Ricky Williams' Discotheque Soul.
I'm not even up.
All right, so that's the break that was used for The Wrath of Cain, those drums.
Oh, word.
Pete Rock used it on the remix to Rampage.
Ah, yes, yes.
You know what I'm saying? So
okay, I know exactly
them
what
drums
you're talking
is
about.
Super crispy. You know what I'm saying? So so those were the two breaks that I had. And actually, as a young kid, I was the man in my area for having those breaks. But my heroes, I just want to touch on this. My heroes in my area, I grew up in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, right? On East 96 and Church. So, you know, a lot of stars were born in that within that little area, right? Because you had Howie T was like the superstar producer.
Hitman Howie T.
Hitman Howie T. And this is even before, like, the I would say the Chub Rock days. Chub Rock was, like, one of my favorite MCs, too, back then. But he had Lil Sean. He had Special Ed. He had a group called Seaborn and Puma that was, you know, it was a local group, but they were dope. You know, he was doing a lot of that Select Record stuff. And I was just like, man, I wish I could get down with these guys. But, you know, I was too young. I was a little snot-nosed kid that just thought I had two breaks, so I thought I was cool. And, but, you know, it didn't stop me from venturing for more records and 45s and albums and listening to sounds and listening to funk and soul. Like, I used to be into Parliament Funkadelic. But growing up in a West Indian home, you know, my dad was always playing country, as
what is that thing with West Indians and country music, man?
Well, I don't know, man. You know, that's just part of culture, man. Like, I was listening to stuff that, man, I just hated in the beginning, but then I grew to like it, like Dolby Gray, you know, looking at a black man singing country and looking at the back of the cover and like, damn, man, like, this is cool, you know? And anyway, man, you know, listen to Kenny Rogers and all that funny stuff. But anyway, so, like, listening to other genres at that time kind of broadened my thing. And one thing I used to do when I was younger living in that area is I used to sneak on a train. I used to get in trouble, but, you know, I would ask my mom for allowance, or I would do bad things like go my dad's wallet when he ain't looking and take out a little $2-3 here and there, jump on a train, on a 3 train, and go up into the city and go to Downstairs Records. And this is when Downstairs Records were in the actual train station. And then later on, they moved to, I think it was like 43rd and 6th Avenue. I could be wrong. 42nd. It wasn't 40. It was 43rd, and so that's when they were upstairs, but they were still called Downstairs Records. And a lot of people back then was coming through there. I used to see Biz Mark when I was young. I used to see, man, just a lot of people, Bambada, Breakbeat Lou, and all these people. And I'm just, like I said, I'm a young, snot-nosed kid, but I'm going in there, didn't have no money, but I would buy a record here and there. And
I caught that bug. What kind of things were you buying back then, like early on?
Oh, snap, man. I was buying Manziel. I was buying...
Wow, they had that in there, like OG copies?
Yeah.
Oh my
yeah.
God!
Yeah, yeah, no, that was real, bro. I would get like, I would get like, Blowfly, you know the anyway, Blowfly would be on one end, and then Catch a Groove would be on the other end. But it was the downstairs record bootlegs, and that was the only version that would have the actual break on it.
Word.
Saying? Yeah, so I would go in there and buy doubles of that, and you know, save up my money and keep going back. And everybody in the store knew me because I was like the little young sensation that was walking in there, like, that's a little motherfucker coming back in there again. I don't know if I could curse, but yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, fuck yeah, man.
Oh, okay, cool, okay. But yeah, I was a little snot nosed kid coming in there buying all this stuff, and then it was like, yo, man, that's a little mother effer coming in here again, man, buying more junk, you know. So, but they liked me after a while because they figured like, I was on to something, and maybe I would be a big inspiring producer. Maybe I would do something with these records one day. I collected for so long, and it was like, I was like, man, I want to do something with these, man. Not just be scratching back and forth. I want to get into production. I want to know how to use a drum machine.
So what year did you catch that bug, that drum machine bug? You know, actually, you know,
okay, so that was
starting to sample records.
So when I had a chance to actually get around some drum machines is when I caught the, like, you know, when Howie T caught wind about me in the neighborhood, right? So one of our heroes, our DJ heroes at that time, DJ, was a Seaborn, right? Seaborn was like big in that area, West Indian dude, but in the hip hop. And like I said, he had his own deal on Select Records. So he brought me over to Howie's house, and I was just blown away. I was like, damn, man. I was like, wow, man. I'm like, this is where all the hits happen. Like Roxanne Shanté, UTFO, and all this shit. And I was like, damn, man. So he let me start rocking on the drum machines he had, and like, and just trying to teach me. He would just give me a few hours and be like, look, man, I'm gonna leave you in here, but go ahead and do your thing. So I was like, I was very appreciative of that, man. And when I got into high school, there was a guy that worked at Music Factory Records, which there was a chain of them around New York City. Like, there was one in Manhattan, there was one in Queens, there was one in Brooklyn. But the one of the managers that was working in the city, he was a dude that was tampering into music and trying to learn how to program. He just had all this stuff set up, and he lived in Queens. So I was going to school in Queens, and he was just like, look, man, you got records, you want to try to sample something? He would let me come over. I would use the 808. And he had like some, I forgot the name of the sampler that he had, but I would like have to like squeeze the sample in the drum in inside the sampler, because it was like you was only getting like a second, so it would sound a little crunchy because the bit rate would like start dumbing down. You know, it's that whole, you know, when people started learning how to use the SP-1200 in the beginning, they would speed the record up,
exactly.
And crunch it in. So that's what I was doing, that before I was even tapping on an SP-1200. You know what I'm saying? With you know, miscellaneous samplers and whatnot. So, but yeah, man. But it was cool. And then I caught that bug, man. I was like, oh man, I'm looking at my first time actually even being around a 808, and I'm seeing the red dots going by, and I was like, yeah, you tap it and it goes by, and I was like, oh, you could take that out and do that. And I was like, I made the first little demo beat I made just for myself, and just, you know, and where I went to school with a cassette tape to brag and say, yo man, I just made a dope beat, was I sampled Melina Shaw's I never forget it I sampled Melina Shaw's California Soul. And I never heard nobody use that, but this is one of the records I bought from Downstairs Records. And I flipped it, and I put a nice little drums up under it, and I had like a local rapper dude from my school, and he did his little thing on it, and then I felt like I had a little crew or whatever, and you know, whatever. It didn't go nowhere, but it was fun to do. You know what I'm saying? And that was my little experience. That was my first like little experience of catching a bug and really just keep trying to pursue it. So, yeah.
Now, when did you get to the point where you go from shopping at record stores to working in a record store?
Oh, okay. So that came a little later. That came in like, I would say like around 90, 91, maybe like 89, 90.
So what year are we talking now? Is this more like 87, 80?
Yeah. Look,
that's early for the Marlena Shaw, man.
Oh yeah, no, but that's what I'm saying. Man, I ain't trying to toot my own horn, man, but I am one of them dudes, man, that was like, I'm pretty sure there was other cats that I just didn't know them, and I didn't, you know, and I was around a lot of big dogs that was catching records, and obviously, you know, you had the Breakbeat Lou's and the Breakbeat Lenny's and all of that was putting together compilations, and you had Paul Winley putting together those Breakbeat compilations. So I'm not saying that, there weren't people that weren't aware of, yo, this record right here.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Had joints, but, I mean, I know I was...
At that point, you hadn't heard anybody.
Nah, I mean, even Ultramagnetic... Trevor, you know, T.R. Love was like one of my mentors coming up. I used to be on the phone with him, man, as a young kid, man. I used to call him up, man. I used to play joints over the phone for him. He's like, yo, that's dope. What's the name of that joint? You know, and it was just like, I told him because I was just like, in the likes of maybe I'll get on an Ultramagnetic joint. You know what I'm saying? Because I was well inspired by them too. But yeah, man. But anyway.
That's crazy, man. But I mean, in New York City, you know, it's crazy to see some of the relationships that you would never, like, I would never in your history, although as rich and musical as it is, based on your discography and based on all the work that you've done, mm-hmm. I would never consider that your history goes back to, like, someone like T.R. Love, who was a mentor to you.
So that's my brother. I love that dude, man. Like, I talked to him up to this day, you know what I'm saying? Like, he's a real pioneer of that SP-1200, man, like. And just making beats. I'm not going to just limit him to that, but he's just a pioneer of just... He was one of the dudes like Marley, like in high regard. Like, I had Marley, Howie T, T.R. Love, even Set G. Like, Set G was like all these cats, you know, was working with BDP and doing all this other stuff. Like, man, they were like my heroes, man, because they were actually taking pieces... Like, where I was thinking to just loop it and, like, stack it, but these guys were actually chopping the pieces out of the record, and I couldn't understand how they were doing that and making it just sound so dope. You know what I'm saying? So that was, like, I was like, man, I just want to inspire, like, these cats. Like, and Teddy Riley, too, man. I don't leave Teddy Riley out. Teddy Riley is a freaking genius to me, man. Even, I used to look at these cats like aliens. You know what I'm saying? Like, we had Area 51... here of beat producers, you know what I'm saying? And it was just like, damn, man, I just want to get inducted, you know, by this whole shit. So, I mean, and that's what I did. I thrived to it, you know what I'm saying? So, anyway.
So talk a little bit about, because we'll get to the record stores, if that happened around 91 or so. But so, right. Like, you know, this era, like 87 to 91, what's happening with you? Are you focused on a group? Are you, because you said you kind of had that, you did that little record with the Marlena Shaw.
Yeah.
You kind of thought you were doing something, you had your, you know, little crew or whatever. And then what kind of happened, transpired between those years?
Well, it was a lot, man. It's so much to talk about now, but... I'll just give you like little things that I encountered like in my journey around that time. Like, okay, me meeting Tip and Ali and, you know, the Tribe and just watching, you know, me just hanging around music like when I was in high school, I used to cut school a lot and just hang out in record stores, right? So I would see Tip.
It's a great fucking way to spend the day.
Oh yeah, man. So I would see Tip hanging out, and this is pre-signing at Jive and everything. So I would see Tip and then Mr. Walt from the Beat Miners. Mr. Walt used to work at the Queens store of Music Factory. So
what's Music Factory without Mr. Walt?
There you go. So yeah, so I used to go in there. I used to see Walt, and Walt was in there stocking the records and showing cats breaks, and he was putting up. I think Walt was like. like really influential in a lot of records that came out of Queens too. A lot of, you know, Walt is dope, man. Shout out to Walt. So I used to see Tip in there playing his demos to, you know, him pre-Tribe and just coming up with ideas. And we used to just be in there like, yo, this is dope, man. Like, oh, snap. And I remember hearing Description, like a Description of a Fool, like, and he played it in the store. I was all blown away. And I also even remember the day that Tip and Fife was like, yo, we going to jump on a train. We walking to Parsons Boulevard right now, and we going to jump on the train and go meet the lady at Jive to go sign our deal. Like, we got our deal. I never forget that. Like, I remember
that's crazy, man.
Yeah, I remember that like it was yesterday. I walked him to the train station like, we made it. I'm like, yo, we, I'm talking French. Like, yo, we made it, son, yo. It was funny, man. But, and so let me see what else around that time, man. Oh, Albie Shaw and Kyle West, which was other mentors to me on the R&B side. But I was signed to them as a producer, too. So they signed me. They were nurturing me. They bought me my first SB1200. So in the likes of just trying to develop me, and you know, they knew I had records, and they knew I at this point now I was starting the program a lot better. You know what I'm saying? So
I just like the idea of Albie Shaw buying a SB1200 for anybody.
Oh yeah, I know, right? Yeah, smooth man. So
that's crazy, man.
But yeah. So they are the ones, man, that helped me really get my start and my kickoff.
It's interesting because right from the beginning, it appears, well, not right from the beginning, but early on in your career, you know, before it even was a career necessarily, mm-hmm. you had these distinct mentors of, you know, real, like, straight up hip hop shit,
yeah.
you know, and R&B shit, yeah. you know, which is kind of the career path that you ended up yeah. carving out for yourself is really yeah. being able to work in both of those lanes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And that yeah. was, like you said, a function of early on, even appreciating people like Teddy Riley, man. So that's really cool, man.
Yeah, well, because I think guys like these guys, man, they would, you know, the stories I used to hear about Teddy Riley, man, was that, look, man, he didn't have much of anything. He's sitting up in his project room with, like, basically one sound module and a little shitty keyboard. Excuse me, and he made everything work. He did Raps New Generation, the Awesome 2. Out of that,
I always forget about that.
The
joint.
Show for Dougie Fresh. I mean, the list goes on. Like, he was, like, when you, in the sense of when you think of Pharrell, like Pharrell's early career, like them just playing joints over and just making beats out of just like maybe. A little, I mean, I'm not going to say it's a shitty keyboard, but just like maybe a decent little keyboard and like maybe a little sound module with some drums in it, some drum sounds. It's like, that's all they did. They just was creative, and it was like not so much sampling, but they would take ideas, implement ideas, interpolate ideas from records and, you know, some of their favorite joints. So, I mean, that's, I just think that's genius, man. You know, so, yeah.
So, fast forward a little bit, we get to the point now where you're now working in the record store. Tell us how that came about, you know what I mean?
Well, the record store I worked at was a guy, no, this was on, for people that's watching this, and New Yorkers and Brooklyn people and Brooklyn diggers, that's been around for a while. There was a store on Fulton Street and Fulton and Franklin Avenue, okay. The store collapsed now. Like, the whole store caved in. The store's been around since, I think the store was put up like 1960 or something like that, right? And then it finally took its toll and just like disintegrated. You know, the whole floor just collapsed.
Like, it literally collapsed. I thought you meant like the business went under, like the business collapsed.
No. I had to go.
Vinyl. Basically, yeah. No, or is it just due to the structure?
No, the store. I had to go. I had the key because I had to be there every morning, opening up the store at. I would say I had to get there like around 8 o'clock, just to, you know. And then, but we didn't. You know, I just had to just get in there, but people didn't start coming in until like around maybe 10:30, 11 o'clock, and I just had to clean up or whatever and just get things straightened or whatever. But yeah, well, one of those trips ended up opening the gate and saying, oh shit, the whole
that's fucked up
fucking store is in the basement. Like that's two stories down.
That's fucking insane.
Yeah, so, but anyway.
What did the owner say when you had to, you know?
I think he had to get rushed to the hospital from a heart attack. That motherfucker was like a stroke or something, because he was like, oh my God, my goddamn store. Oh shit, baby, what we gonna do, man? Oh, you know, because this was a store that he came in and he, you know.
What was the name of the store?
512.
512.
Well, it didn't have no specific thing. It was just like old mom and pop record store. But anyway, I was in there for a while. They took me in, and the guy couldn't pay me. Right? He couldn't. He they didn't have no money, because I was the cat. You know, the store was in there. It was old, man. But they had a lot of dead stock shit from the 60s. Right? You talking about like they would buy records. You know, they would order in records, but then they didn't move a lot of that shit, and they don't know about breaks and what the young cats is looking for. But, you know, I came in and said, hey, man, I could move a lot of these records. But they was like, okay, young blood, we can't pay you it much. But I said, okay, oh, yes, you can. Let me tell you how you can pay me. You see this bag? I'm going to fill up this bag every day. I'm going to take some records. I'm going to stuff the bag up. And, you know, just make sure I get something to eat for lunchtime.
This sounds like employee of the month status to
me. So think about it. I'm working in there for like 3 years. And you can imagine. So if I'm working out of there with records for 3 years, you do the math.
Wow.
You do the math. So here's the funny shit, man. And I tell cats this all the time, right? I mean, I don't have everything. I don't, cause you know who's the 45 guru in my eyes. The 45 guru is Kenny Dope. Shout out to Kenny Dope. Kenny Dope is the motherfucking 45 guru. I don't know much people that's fucking with him, bro.
Well, I mean, just based off the shit that he posts on social media, and I know that's not even a fraction.
You're not fucking. You're not fucking with Kenny. You're not fucking with Kenny. You're not fucking with Kenny. You're not fucking. You're not fucking with Kenny.
When he's posting acetates and you know.
Well, yeah, it's like when you get to that level, it's a whole other. Yeah,
Kenny, I hope you're watching this, because I'm telling the truth about you, my brother. Like you are like the 45 God. So, but anyway, so check it out. So anyway, being in the store for 3 years, I was getting my records like crazy. Now check this shit out. I was getting shit out of there that I didn't necessarily like. And I don't know who the fuck like it. I just like, oh, it's got a little groove, soul. And, you know, some of the shit might be fast, or it'd be Northern soul, or it might be 60s soul. So a lot of that shit, I'm just
like. And were a lot of these things like dead stock copies? Like dead stock copies. Okay, so I got five of these, three of these, four of these. Let's see.
And shit that I didn't give a fuck about. Type situation. In 2015, I can go through that same collection of maybe over 20,000 45s, right? No bullshit. And I'm going on PopSyke, and I'm going on Craigslist, $1,500, $2,000 45s. Those same ones that I just said I don't give a fuck about.
That's crazy.
Check that shit out. Check that shit out.
So like Northern
No. Sometimes I sell on eBay, and I just sold a 45 just now to an English he's not an English dealer, he's an English DJ. And I sold two of the same records that I didn't, you know, I was just like, oh, whatever. I had like six copies. I sold two copies. Each copy was $2,500 each. So I just made $5,000 off of two records. And my hand to God, bro. No bullshit. And these are the records that came out of that store.
That's amazing, man.
So
good on you, bro.
God forbid I ever go. God forbid anything. Yes. God forbid anything. If I ever go, you know, get fucked up and I'm in a jam and I need money. I could just, all I need to do, if I need some quick cash, I could just go, doo 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 doo, $10,000 each. I mean, not $10,000 each, but $10,000 for that, yeah. For a little small little stack, if I really want to. And it's real.
Yeah. It's real. I mean, yeah, so, damn. Anyway. Well, you have it your way, basically, you know, trades, whatever kind of situation.
And it's still a lot of shit I'm looking for, man. I mean, Man, I'm still looking for this record, Rory Rowe. I think it's called Have It Your Way by Rory Rowe, which it's still fucking impossible to get my hands on.
Was it an album, a 45?
It's only a 45. It was given away at a festival, Bismarck always tells me. Bismarck has a couple of copies. Marley Marl used it for the symphony. It's the drum break that's under the symphony. Yeah. Used it for Master Ace's... Okay. Money in the Bank, Large Professor used it.
It's got the smile on the record.
That's
the one.
That's one of the ones I'm looking for. So
yeah, Joe Run Bomb.
Holler at me, anybody that has a copy that want to do a trade or want to sell one, because I will put up that bread for that 45.
Word.
That's real.
So talk to me a little bit about, because I know, you know, your cousin K Cut is in the building too. Shout out to K Cut.
Shout out to K. Because
I know he shared with us, you know, some stories. Of you know your days sort of putting people on the records, because you were, you know, that was something that you did as well. And I know when you walked in the house, you saw the Giant record, you're like, yo, I found that record. I discovered. So talk to me a little bit about, you know what I mean, some of the records that, you know, you discovered and that you then put people onto, because I think that's important, you know.
There's a record for the nerds. Okay, so there's a drum break called Brethren.
Yep. You know, of course, that? Man,
I was the first one to find that record.
Come on!
Kay, am I lying? Kay's in the house, as a matter of fact.
Yo.
Nah, he ain't lying.
I'm the first one to find that record. I used it. I looped in on Bismarck's Take It to the Top, the album that he got sued on, I Need a Haircut.
So he
shouts me out, and I looped it up on there, and then everybody else just started going crazy for the record. Because the word just started getting out. But I was the first one. Giant is another one I found. Now, I'm going to put y'all up on something else. In Brooklyn, in East New York, Brooklyn, which was notorious for, like, you could get fucking hung out there. It's real out in East New York. That's, you know, home of Mike Tyson and, you know, real motherfuckers, Group Home, MOP, Brownsville, East New York, same shit. I used to live out there, too, after Flatbush. But there was a spot called Livonia, and it was on Livonia Avenue. I can tell the story now because the spot is not there anymore and they don't have records. But it was a junk spot where it was a junk furniture spot where they would do cleanouts if, like, somebody gotten evicted or, like, you know, move outs and people just left shit behind. People would hire this spot. So, or somebody died or old jazz musician or whatever, and there would be records in there. So what I'm about to tell y'all, you're not going to fucking believe it, but it's a dead-ass true story. They're in the basement of this building. They had so many fucking records in the building because what they did, like, they would get all the furniture and they would leave everything else upstairs, right? Mm-hmm. But the records, they would just literally just take boxes of records and just dump it like it was fucking soil to, like...
Like a fucking
laundry
chute, just like...
Yeah, just... Dump it like this. Here's the stairs. The stairs is here, so they wouldn't even bother to walk downstairs. Rats and shit down there.
Man, fucking that's flagrant. That's just like
right.
Wow.
Hold on. They would take the records every fucking week, every day, every week. Guys would just keep coming in with records and just throwing records downstairs. So when fuck? Hold on.
This is so fucked up.
No, hold on. So you walk downstairs. Now, you can't walk that. You can't. Your feet don't touch the ground.
Yeah, because you're sliding on records.
5 feet high of records. Do you understand what I just said to you, right? 5 feet high of records. So, I would bring motherfuckers down there. So, you would be skiing on records. So, we would be downstairs. We would be downstairs, like... having fun. Like, I would bring Beat Miners, I'd bring Q-Tip, I'd bring all these people. We'd be downstairs having fun and flinging records at each other, shit, having fights with records. And so that's where I would find my creme de la creme of the illest shit in the world. Like, but some motherfuckers I would bring down there, because I didn't want to give that jewel up. This is like the days of like when everybody wasn't looking for like Blue Note collections of like Lou Donaldson and fucking Ronnie Foster and all the so I because my bulk of my albums came from that basement. They were giving you each record for 10 cents, so you're talking about some shit was sealed. So I was going down there, coming out every day with a suitcase. Me and my man Latif, another cousin of ours, Latif, which is another beast on records, like fucking beast. We would go down there with a suitcase every day and just fill up the suitcase, like big ass, like gaudy ass fucking suitcases, and just fill the whole shit up with records and walking out of there every day. So our collection was just like, that's why when I told you, that's why when I say to you, like, I could just fill up 2 to 3 whole fucking rooms just from top to bottom of just fucking albums. And I still have that collection up to this day. So all these records, when you go to all these expensive high-end record stores that's selling you shit at like $30, $40 to even $500, I got that shit back then for 10 cents. And this is early.
That's amazing, man. That's, you know, amazing. That's pretty nice, though, that you spread that jewel around. Live convention
sealed. One, wow. You know, 81, in, you know, both versions sealed up. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, we listen, man.
That's crazy,
that's
man.
Why when I hear cats talking about collections, like even Kay and Large Pro fucking collections back then was just, I mean, when you listen to Main Source first album, man, it's like, dude, they was pulling out the most illest shit in the fucking world, the obscure to a bitch. It's like, come on, man.
I know, that's shit,
think
was,
about it,
was
and well put together. It's, oh, like, it was, come on, man.
People still don't know to this day. People are, right, asking, like, you know, be quizzing you about
it's
that.
Real, man.
That was so, like, the like Main Source to me was that bridge between like a Tribe and a Bomb Squad. It was like,
yes,
the combination of those two worlds. Like, everything was just, you know what I mean? It was smooth, but they always had like the little hardcore breakdowns and the scratches and the little change-ups. Oh, yeah, all the little, absolutely, layers
it
and
was,
shit.
It was like a
Bomb Squad thing, but the vibe of it was more like, you know, progressive, you know, at the time. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it was just one of those things, man. It was like when you heard it, man, you was mesmerized, man. It was like, damn, man, like this is a fucking masterpiece, man.
Straight up.
And up,
man,
to this day, it's still a masterpiece.
100%.
Still has the same effect.
You know what I mean?
100%, man.
From even like the even the remixes, you know what I'm saying? That Large
remix.
Yeah, come on, man. I mean, Large is Large.
Early
Large
on that Black Ruby.
Yeah, Large is a sensei, man. Like he was one of the people also that really kind of gave me that granted me that whole Paul C flavor, man. Just teaching me, man. Like little, you know, some of the little tricks and just, you know, just how to just do intros and all that shit. So I'm very grateful for the rest of my life to Large, man. Because, you know, I mean. It was to the point where it was like I was with Large Pro like every day. Like he would let me, he would have a spare apartment. He would be like, yo, bro, just come out with the records. Come stay over there. You know what I'm saying? So he really taught me my shit, man. So, yeah. He was another one that he kind of took me up under his wing also during his like super Pete Rock days. Like Shut Him Down remix, his first album and all that shit when he was hot. So he was giving me. He was giving me some love with some of his artists, and you know, it took me up under his wing, and it didn't last long, but he gave me some opportunities. Like I said, man, shout out to Pete, man, you my brother, man, I love you, man, it's all good.
Now, there's obviously information on the internet, but you know, there's stuff that goes deeper than that. Your first official production credit, according to Discogs, and I don't know how accurate this is, so I'm glad we have you to verify, yes, is Making Moves with Puff. Craig Mack.
Oh, wow.
Now, according to them, so right, you just mentioned the Latifah's Had It Up to Here remix, which I know predates that. Mm-hmm. Is there any stuff like that that they may not have got right that,
well,
you know what I mean, that came before that, or maybe you ghost-produced and didn't get,
okay,
the full credit, or stuff like that that will be...
So when me and Large hooked up, man, and he started taking me up under his wing and showing me a lot of love, I think it was my last year in high school, right? Around that time. And I think he was still going to Bound also or whatever. So what happened was I went to a Def Jam Christmas party. I'm young And I don't even know how the fuck I got in there, but I got in there somehow because I was in there drinking and doing all type of stupid shit. I seen Rakim. Now I'm nervous as fuck because I'm like, this is the god. This is the fucking god MC, Rakim. So I came up to him. I had a few things that I was like, I didn't even have beats. I had like pause loop ideas. So I was like, I was arranging whole beats. Like I was doing some incredible shit. Like, you know how like you would hear a bunch of samples slapped together, but then you was doing it on a drum machine. You was arranging it on a drum machine. Mm-hmm. I was arranging that shit with pause looping. So I would get this one part from the record, and then I would take the next record that I would want, you know, to make probably the verse, and I'll pause loop that back in, then come back with the other record, and then. So I had a few of those, and they was pretty cool. So I was cocky enough. I was like, man, fuck that. I think I had too many drinks. I was like, man, I'm going to come up to the guard, man. knowing that he might smack the shit out of me. Like, get the fuck out of here. You know what I'm saying? But it was all good. I just came up to him, and I said, yo, man, peace, Ra. I'm a young little dude. I'm on the streets. But I respect you, da da da. You know, I'm just nervous and gibbering and shit. But I was like, yo, man, I would love to play you some records. And I started naming records to him to see if he knew this. And you know. So he was like, yo, babe, Paul, man. You know, word up, man. Here's my number, man. Just hit me up, man. You know what I'm saying? So I was like, oh shit, I got Rakim's number. So the following day, hit him up. This time he was living on 19th Street in Chelsea. He was living in Chelsea at the time. And went up to his house. He had the whole little, he had a room where he had the whole setup. And it was dope, man. It was just like, oh shit, like, fuck, here's my chance to really just, you know, like, show him some shit. So I did, and I ended up, he started just taking me into the studio, and he was like, yo, nah, man, I want you to stay up here. Like, I want you to just keep working. Like, let's just keep working, because we got a good little chemistry going. At the end of it all, I'm going to get into the songs that I produced on that album, but at the end of the day, like, I didn't get credited for it, but people on the street and people in the industry and people at the labels knew that I did those records. So it ended up, the credit ended up saying Eric B. and Rakim produced the whole album. And it's cool, man. You know, I was young and I was just trying to just get on. So I ended up doing Don't Sweat the Technique, which was...
Wow.
Right? Another one I did was called Teach the Children. The other one I did was called Kick Along.
Yep.
What was the other one? I did a lot of songs, but four only ended up. I don't remember the other one offhand. So anyway, you know, that was like my really first major thing that I was a part of.
That's amazing,
as a,
man.
As a kid, you know, trying to get my feet wet and. You know what I'm saying? And it was just, you know, it was a good experience. Like, I'm not going to say I didn't get paid, because Rod actually, like, when we had all the record shows, the record conventions, Rod just was like, yo, man, here's this whole list. And I was like, wow, this is a lot of fucking money. I was like, for me? I said, yo, babe, Paul, just go ahead, man. Just go hold that down, man. You good, man. So funny. I was like, wow. So, excuse me. I wasn't mad that it wasn't nothing extra per track or whatever. It was more so the experience.
Yeah, it's your first time. I'm being around Rakim.
Yeah, I'm being around G-Rap. I'm being around, you know, a lot of people, and I, you know what I'm saying. It was a great experience for me. So it was like, man. But here's another blessing that came out of that situation. Rakim introduced me to Puffy. So me hanging around Ra. I'm trying to remember the party that it was a party that Funkmaster Flex used to do every week in the city. But I went up in there with Rakim. Puffy was in there. Puff used to be on a mic with Funkmaster, because it was Puff's party with Flex. I never forget that. And it happened every week. So he introduced me to Puff and was like, yo, I need you to take my little man under your wing. So this is when Puff was still at, it wasn't, he didn't even have Bad Boy yet. This was
Uptown?
He was still, he was A&R at Uptown Records. So I started doing a lot of those sessions with Puffy. Puffy just started having me come in, programming with the SP, worked on a lot of those records also, Mary J. Blige, Jodeci, you name it, Christopher Williams. So if you know the remixes I'm talking about without me getting into it,
then, wow, like what's the Christopher Williams joint? Hey, every little something.
Hey,
what's it called?
Hey, man,
everything. I can't remember the one with the wake and all that.
We're on the same. So
wow, there you that's have crazy, it, man.
Funky Fresh in the Flesh.
So you were doing a lot of that stuff, but not same situation, not getting full credit for it.
Not yet. But it started, that momentum started building up, right? So like so when it came down to Mary's album on What's the 411 and then a lot of the remixes, Puff was like, yo, that's when I was like, I'm gonna be, you know, my name of my production thing is Tumbling Dice. That's the birth of it, right? And it was me and another cat named Avon Avias, and he actually played on. The reason why I hooked up with him, because he was a really dope session keyboard player, and he played on the Real Love remix and what was it? The other Mary remix is the one with CL and Pete on there. But anyway, I can't remember offhand. But so he played on all that stuff, and I was like, "Yo, dude, let's link up, man. Let's rock, man." And so we formed Tumbling Dice together, right? And yeah, so all the remixes for Mary from that 411 album was us, and it was credited for it. And we was like, "Oh man, we're on a roll." So
are some big remixes, man. Like,
oh, thank you. Yeah,
Real Love is, I mean, still cracks to this day. You know cool, what I'm saying?
Yeah, and also, man, the other thing is that when I was still doing that, me and Avon were doing other stuff, like with Bill Stephanie, that used to be over at Def Jam. He had a record. He had a company called. I can't remember. I'm sorry, man. But he had an artist called Miss Jones.
Yep.
All right. So there was a record. The first record we did actually her half of her album.
And is that like Where I Want to Be?
And Where I Want to Be. Yeah, we didn't produce that one. I think that was Ron G that did that one. But I did Don't Front. That was her first single where I sampled Jungle Brothers, and we did that whole thing. But that was another like. It wasn't that big, but a lot of people knew it, and it got some good spins and everything. But that was another like major thing we were on. I mean, other than the Uptown stuff, and it just started building from there, man. We just kept going and kept going and kept going, and yeah.
And what was it like working with Puff in those early years? You know what I mean? Like as far as like you know, how closely did you work with him in terms of like him directing you or him being in the lab? And
I'm gonna say this one thing, man, and make it clear, bro. Like Puff is the one that polished me as a producer. He taught me how to make records. Like anybody could say. Puff, or any of the old producers from back in the days that want to get into the blogs or want to get into magazines and say that he never did anything, that's, no, he didn't actually touch any keyboards. Maybe every once in a while, like, if he knows the way he wants it, and he'll say, set this up for me with the 950 or whatever in the keyboard and just put the sample in there, and I'll tap it in myself. Puff did do that. So I can't. That's bullshit. Because I was in a lot of those sessions, even with other producers, and watched him do it, and he did it with me. But anyway, I worked hand in hand with Puff, very closely with Puff, and Puff knows exactly what he wants, and he'll tell you, or he'll say, "Yo, here's the vocals to this. I need you to come up with the right thing for this." and then I'll make sure that you know the other stuff is right. Like he'll bring in if he needs Mr. Cheeks from from the group
Lost Boys
and whatever it takes. He knows how to arrange the records. You know, he is the hip hop Quincy Jones in a sense.
Yeah, for sure, man.
You know what I mean? I know that for sure. So I would never front on him, but he actually molded me into being a really good producer, man. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it's really, I mean, and I think there's a distinction between people that make beats and people who are producers in terms of...
Well, I was a beat maker.
At that time. And he maybe helped polish you to become a producer.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
To think like that. And definitely. I think that's an important thing. Because even, I mean, the James Brown doc, if you see that, you get to really see that. He was playing with some really talented musicians.
Absolutely.
But he couldn't necessarily read music or... But he knew how to... He knew what he wanted. He would just hum a bass line or say, you know what I mean? Like, that was his way of you know, sort of getting his vision across. And he worked with incredible people, and he picked the right people, which I think is a talent as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Zeroing in on the right people to work with.
I mean, I seen Puff mold a lot of producers and help them and shape their sound as well. Like, I mean, I don't want to say any more names or put them out there because I don't want them to say, oh, well, how are you going to say that about me? Because I'm already, you know. So, but anyway, a lot of other producers that he worked with, I know for a fact he helped mold them as well.
Yeah, so. and I think a lot of them would say the same thing as well. You know what I mean?
I'll let them say that.
Take the liberty and speak.
Nah. I speak for myself and you know for my crew, but yeah.
So moving on past that, I mean, once you start really getting into this Bad Boy era, you already have a relationship with Puff, and then you got these records like this Craig Mack record that comes out, you know, Flavor in the Year, which is a big record, which Easy Mo B did.
Yeah.
But then you had the Making Moves with Puff, and then, you know, the Biggie record comes out, which I'm sure was, you know, a game changer being affiliated with the camp at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do arguably the, you know, in my eyes, the biggest record off that album. I know Juicy was the record, but One More Chance Remix.
Yeah.
Is...
Well, that record wasn't on the album. That's on the repackaging of the album.
Which they had to do.
He had a couple of remixes and a couple of things that was doing well, like Who Shot Ya. I know they repackaged it because of Who Shot Ya, One More Chance Remix, Dreams, which is another record of mine, and two more other things, but yeah.
Wow, so. You did Dreams too.
Yes, sir.
Did you do the original What's the 411 remix?
Yes, I did.
With the Superman Lover?
Yes.
Word. Because
yes.
he kicked that Dreams.
Well, yeah. I always explain that to people that's the same. So, okay, so the What's the 411 remix with Mary, so you have that, but then that same James Brown Blues and Pants was up under the Superman Lover.
Oh, word.
Yeah, so if you listen to it towards the end... of that remix, the Mary remix, you'll hear. So Tim Dog was the A&R over at what do you call it, at Uptown.
You're talking about Butt Naked Tim Dog?
Butt Naked Tim Dog, yes. Okay, so he
different from Penicillin on Wax Tim Dog.
Right. Oh yes. Oh anyway. So you know, I don't know if he, I don't know what's the story about if he really passed away or not, but I mean, if he did, I mean, God bless the dead, man. God bless him. But anyway, Tim Dog went back in there with Big and said, yo, he stripped down my top layer of the sample, right? And then he just used the bottom layer of Blues and Pants and then had Biggie come back in and redo that. So then I had to go in there and just like, you know, just kind of just do the little drops and add the little kick and snare and that kind of thing. So that's how that one came about. So, I mean, that's really, to be honest, I produced that record, but then Tim kind of really made that happen. You know what I'm saying? So it is, you know, it is what it is, man.
But this was an interesting time in the industry in particular because, you know, especially for a guy like yourself who, you know, we've seen has come from King Tim III, personality jock to, you know, doing your own music, looping up records like California Solo, working with TR Love to meeting Tribe and doing work with Rakim.
Yeah.
And now you're part of this Bad Boy era, which is, this is like, hip hop has never been this big. This is the biggest it's been. You know what I mean? With the exception of what Dre was doing on the West Coast, you guys were the biggest thing in music. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about what that was like at that time, man. It must have been a crazy time in your career.
Well, I'll put it to you this way, man. Like, as far as like when all of that was going down with the whole East Coast, West Coast thing, and Bad Boy, at that time I dipped out from there because it was like, you know, contract wise between me and Puff, it was just we were like going towards the end of it, and it was just kind of like, well, I'm doing so much outside of this, like, it just makes sense. And that's when he was doing the Hitman, so I was like, let me venture off and let me kind of see what I could do. Now, I don't know if this is cocky to say, but I mean, not too many of the producers that left that situation really, you know, had too much success outside of Bad Boy. I think I was one of them, you know what I'm saying? Because like, here you got Busta, you got you got LL Cool J, you got you're doing Seal. I'm being an exec over at Motown Universal. Well, it wasn't Motown, it was Motown Polydor at the time. So then I was, you know, me and Kay was doing a lot of that work over there. Like, I was, you know, being an exec, but then you had 98 Degrees, you had you had Boys to Men over there, you had all this other shit.
And those are big fucking records.
Yeah, man. you had all this work that it was just like, oh man, it's open field. And I was hiring other producers as well. But so I was doing that, and then, you know, going on to being a co-exec on Space Jam, Michael Jordan Space Jam.
Word.
So, and then, you know, producing Seal and that kind of thing. So it was just like, I felt like, man, I achieved a lot at that time. And it was just like, man, I couldn't go back to being signed to a production company / management. And I just felt like it was just kicking me back in the dirt, and it was just like I didn't feel like I was going anywhere. So, but me outside looking back in, it was just kind of like, damn, man, like this is crazy, man. Like, this is a lot of shit that's going on right now, and it just got out of control, man. Because I didn't think that should have went as far as it did. You know, I mean, a lot of that stuff could have been controlled, but because of, you know, a lot of egos on both coasts, and, you know, everybody has a point to prove. It was like, it just ended up in violence, and it shouldn't have been that way.
Oh, absolutely not, man. You know, I mean, obviously, in retrospect, it's easy to see, you know. I mean, even at the time, I'm sure people saw how foolish it was, but
yeah.
it was heated, you know. I mean, people were definitely mad at that time. Mm-hmm. But like you said, you exited that situation, and you know, you sort of diffused that for yourself, and then you go on to do records like, you know, If I Rule the World,
yes,
with Nas, you know, which you're credited on a lot of these records as co-producer. So
you know what time it is, man.
That's why I'm asking, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get too much into it, man. I just put it to you this way, man. A lot of people understand that kind of language, right? It's like, when you see that, it's like, well, is this guy really the producer, or is he? I ain't here to like, you know, be the guy that's kicking dirt back on Trackmasters and Steve Stout, man. I mean, I still talk to these guys up to this day. So I feel very fortunate to even be a part of that thing, man. I'm you know, like. Some people, you know, when you tell some people that shit, they'd be like, damn, I wish I was even had a fucking credit somewhere, even just on the print of that shit. So it's like, I just appreciate that, man. I mean, that's just my history. It's like,
but,
I can't.
But your name isn't on all these classics by accident, is what I'm saying. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You made a lot of classic records, man. Like Wu-Ha.
Thank you.
Busta, your shit for Busta. Like, obviously I love Wu-Ha. I love fucking Dangerous. Like,
Thank you, sir.
That record is incredible to me.
Yeah.
But when I was reminded that you did Rhymes Galore, B.
I did.
That was my fucking jam, man.
K-Cut of Main Source was right there when I made that beat, and I basically did that shit. I think I might have did that beat like 20 minutes, because I wanted to do one of my favorite beats, whether fast or slow, was always Rufus Thomas, Do the Funky Penguin. right?
Word.
So I was like, damn, how can I flip this without just looping it? Because everybody looped it. Like, you know, when you hear Sir Abu, Divine Force, Holy War, with Funky Penguin in there, cut up, you know, over Substitution, it's like, damn, man, that's real classic hip hop. But damn, what's the next? How can I flip it? So I said I wanted to be on. I know giving a beat to Busta is like, you got to think like a fucking cyborg. Like, it's like, you know, it's, you really need to, like, you know, you puff out and it's like you just start seeing some other shit. So I was like, damn, I need to just fucking make some other shit. So I had a fucking broken ass Moog, you know, like a mini Moog, and my SP-1200 just in the room at that time. And I said, yo, I'm just going to play that bass line over and I'm going to just flip some fucking drums and make that shit sound just like that. And it worked. You know what I'm saying? So, and I gave it to Busta. Busta's face. You know how, like, when you look at paint, you know how when you look at fucking paint and the paint start cracking? That's how Busta's face was. Busta's fucking face just started. It's like, yo, oh, shit, man. He started doing all this shit. I said, yo, boss, you gonna have a fucking seizure, B. Like, relax your face. He was like, yo. Started grabbing. You know, Buster does this shit where he grabs your fucking shirt and, like, he'll rip the fucking butt. Like, he feeling the beat. Like, you walk out, excuse me. You start walking out of there like, you gotta change your shirt, bro. Like, he rips it apart. Like, he's so excited that he scrunches up.
Man,
you know,
he's giving him heat like rhymes galore, man. You know, he's gonna have to pay for like garments to get like.
Yeah, right.
Coming through with a tape and like slaps like that, like
Busta's a beast, man.
Yeah, man, wardrobe's getting.
He might be wearing some good ass clothes too, man.
He gonna rip that shit right off your. Damn, you might rip your hair out. You got dreads, he'll rip that shit right out. Come out with a bald spot.
Note to all, you know, producers out there, if you have the good fortune of working with Busta Rhymes, just wear a really shitty T-shirt to the session in case he really.
Let me tell you who could tell you that. DJ Scratch could verify what I'm saying. Easy Mo B, Just Blaze. It's a lot of people that Diamond D could tell you. A lot of these cats, man, they could tell you like how when you go in the you go in a space with Busta. First of all, and you need earplugs because Busta gonna turn that shit on 20 and it's only 10 on the board. Like he's gonna just, your ears is gonna ring for like 2 weeks. Like, yeah, I love that spirit, man. Like he's about the music, man. You know, so.
You know, and you work with Erykah Badu as well. I know you actually had a little situation with her. I don't know if it was it a group or something called Frequency.
Frequency is our little production crew that we have. It's like me, her, James Poyser, R.C. Williams, which is an incredible producer and keyboard player, and he's her MD on the road as well. So he's shout out to those guys. Yeah, man, Erykah is my sister, man. I love her, man. She saved me from a period of time where I was like, man, I mean, you know, I guess I could talk about it, man. It was like, it was a time, man, in my life after my mother passed away that, I was like in a deep depression and I didn't want to make music. Cause then, you know, it was just like, I was just trying to find my niche. Like my little sister had died from brain cancer and she was only, at the time, like 21, and she just had a kid, and then the next year she died, and then my mother died like some years right after, and I was like in a deep depression, man. I didn't want to make music. So when I met Erykah, man, now she comes and says, yo, I need to work with you, you know, because I was introduced to her through James Poyser, which is Heroes with the Roots, and he's an incredible producer as well. For you know, Jill Scott.
Of course.
Yeah, everybody. So list goes on. My brother. So, yeah. So Erykah was like, "Look, I'm redoing my band for the road, and I need you to come roll with me." And she's like, "I'm working on my new album, and the name of the album is called Worldwide Underground because I'm trying to make this real beat driven." Hip hop vibe, and you know, something a little bit different than what I've been conventionally doing and shit. So I was like, yeah, hell yeah. I think I can get into it. She was like, yeah, I'm gonna take you all around the world with me as my DJ. And then while we're in each city, we'll stop at a studio on our days off and work on this album. So that's what happened. And then but before I went on the road, she had me come into Electric Lady Studios, which is in Manhattan, in the East Village, which is Jimi Hendrix's personal studio, right? And she was like, I'm working on a song for the soundtrack. And I was like, oh, cool. I was like, okay, cool. And she played me the song, and it was Love of My Life. And it was a record that she worked on with her and Rafael Siddiq. Now, she said that she played it for me, and then I was like, yo, this is dope. I'm like, what the fuck you want me to do, right? So she's like, I need you to just make magic happen with it, right? So what do you want me? You want me to change the drums? You want me to, you want me to come in and rearrange it, whatever? She was like, yeah, do what you got to do. So I pull up the MPC 3000. I had a whole bunch of zip drive floppies. And I was like, shit. I pulled up an old TLC record that, it was a beat that I did for TLC that never made the album, right? So I just pulled up that program and I just hit play and shit worked. Just the drum part of that record. And Erica left the room for about 2 hours and she came back and was like, oh shit. It was magic. And then, I ended up, producing, co-producing with Raphael and Erica, Love of My Life. And so after that, it was like, yo, you got to come on a roll with me. So I've been touring with her since then. And I was like, almost 10 years ago when that song came out.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I ended up, I even was an executive producer on that whole sound, on that, not the soundtrack, but the EP of Worldwide Underground, and did every song on the album. So, which was Danger, I Want You,
I Want You was the jam.
Cool, man. Yeah, that was just, that song in particular was just on some West Indian vibes. We were just in there just vibing, shaking our heads, and just vibing out and just, whatever, man. Like some more like Naya Bingy kind of Rasta Man kind of thing, So, yeah, it was cool.
So, obviously we've talked a lot about your history in terms of all the things that you've, different things that you've sort of touched project-wise. Is there something that, people tend to focus on but kind of, overlook in your catalog, which you feel is kind of like, something that you're very personally, proud of? Like, you mentioned you produced Seal. I had no idea that you produced Seal.
Fly Like an Eagle. Yeah, me and K-Cut. Yeah. So that was fun. Those were some interesting sessions because Seal now, right? He had so many ideas on how he felt like it should go, and we were coming up with so much ideas, right? And he was, I ain't gonna put him out there like that, but anyway, man. But it was all good, man. It was a fun record, man. It was a fun record to work with, man.
Yeah. No doubt. But are there any other gems like that in terms of like sort of stuff that you feel personally, close to that we haven't spoken on that you feel like doesn't get the light of day or doesn't get the?
It's a lot of shit, man. Like, okay, so when I so let's treadmill back, right? So like, so another one of my records that a lot of people might not realize it's me. Just on the underground backpacking scene is Rampage's Beware of the Ramsack. Yeah, that was my record because it says my credit reads Al G Rashad, and my DJ name back in the days was Algebra. Everybody used to call me Algebra. So
what?
So why? Then so why? So out so Al G so then I said, man, that shit is corny, man. I'm just calling myself Al G. I kept going through so many fucking names. I was like, Al G sounds like some dirty ass shit that's on the bottom of a fishbowl.
So when you listen to
Tribes,
Electric Relaxation,
he said,
right?
And my man Al G. So he's talking about me. And it's funny because I'm just like, but damn, man, I gotta find me a fucking cool ass you know, identity, man. Like, this shit is crazy. So I just went back to Rashad Smith, you know, and everybody called me Ringo from an old Jamaican cult movie called Smile Orange. So Ringo is like the main, you know, main character. Shit. Dirty nigga. So, yeah. Anyway, so.
But yo, Rashad, man, we want to thank you, man, once again for coming through, man, and chopping it up with.
Thank you for having me.
You know, with Cratery, man. And hopefully, man, we can get you to, if there's still time left, man, to dig through some of these joints right quick, man, and pick out a couple man. little yeah, joints for a little special Cratery set,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
All right, any shout outs before we go?
Shout out to Toronto, man, the whole of Toronto, everybody. It's all good.
It's all good, man. Cratery FM, you know what it is, man. K